What is a typical day like for a real estate broker, real estate person? What sort of routine would you typically follow if you say you had one, or maybe have groups of routines at varying times?
You do something for so long you don't think about it, you know, you just want to do it. And I did that for 30 years. So I did it for a fair length of time, but you know, the normal day would start about 8 or 8:30 in the morning, and go to the office. The day starts at the office normally. Once in a while, you'd have something to do on the way in, drive by a property to look at the outside, or maybe put a sign in the yard, or you know, normally not seeing or talking people. But, you know, typically, you know, going to the office 8 to 8:30, if you're working with people, if you're kind of working on other people's scheduling, because it's a people business. You don't really sell property, you don't list property, you sell people and you list people. It's a people business. And so your schedule has to fit everybody else's schedule. And so if you're working with someone that's, maybe it's best to talk to them in the morning, your day starts by, you know, making phone calls to, you know, on other people's schedules, so you know, you can talk to them at their convenience. You know, I've called people at 6 in the morning just because that's when they were available. But, you know, normally, you go to the office, do some of that, you kind of sit down and kind of organize your day if it wasn't already organized for you, things you had to do. There's a certain amount of paperwork, listing updates in your multiple listing directory, if you had letters to write, work on the computer. Normally you do those things in, you know, in the morning, or because usually that's when you weren't seeing people or showing property or meeting with people. That typically would take place a lot of lunch hours, afternoons, evenings, you know, but not first thing in the morning. And as your day would, you know, would develop, your time would be spent more talking to people, customers, clients. You know, if you were working with someone, you know, showing them property, a lot of times they, you know, they'd have to do it on a noon hour, so you get a lot of noon hours. 12 o'clock appointments were really common. Mid morning through the afternoon, that's kind of when your day develops as far as actually seeing and talking, I guess. Lots of times, if you were having to meet someone, you know, if it was on a weekday, a typical time would be 5 o'clock. You know, people like to kind of get their day done, so they, you know, they'd want to see you, or vice versa, like maybe right at the end of their work day and before their evening got started, dinner hour, and that sort of thing. If they had property to look at, you know, that was a very common time, 5 to 6, 6:30 in there. They seemed to, you know, like to do it at those times, and like I said, you know, it's a, your day revolves around what's convenient for everybody else, not what's best for you normally.
So you would say that, I guess that we would say that a lot of people might think that a real estate person is a business job that's like a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday, but this wouldn't be true at all.
No, you're a 24/7 job.
Uh-huh.
We didn't keep the office open on weekends. Now that business has changed in the last few years. Most real estate offices in La Grande anyway are open on weekends. Some towns, they're open all weekend. That's a big time, and obviously it's, you know, good reason for it. But, you know, it was interesting. We'd have people come here from bigger cities to want to look at property on a weekend. And all the real estate offices in town would be closed. They couldn't believe it. They said, "Gosh, you guys, where we're from, that's prime time. Everybody's out really working, you know, we come to the Grand and everything's closed.
So is that where you would accommodate
do it by appointment.
Would they call and tell you this, or
well,
how did you know or catch on that
well,
you didn't miss any customers, did you?
Well, yeah, sometimes, because if someone just came in cold turkey, didn't have any, you know, had made arrangements ahead of time to see someone, if they just came into town on a Saturday or Sunday and expect to walk into a real estate office and get property information, that's when we get that reaction. And I talked to people that had spent the weekend in town, and then they'd leave, and on Monday they'd call back to a office, sometimes our office, and they'd say, hey, we were in town this weekend and we couldn't find anybody to talk to. So it was kind of interesting, small town LeGrand, that's just the way everybody operated. That's changed now a little bit, probably only the last maybe 7 or 8 years. And most offices are open on Saturdays, but none on Sundays. And most of them are open Saturday morning. They have someone to man the office. And then it's by appointment. You know, spend a lot of weekends working, but it's by appointment when we do that.
So you'd still be working Sundays occasionally?
Occasionally,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But would tend to be by appointment at that time.
Yeah. I've always chuckled about days off. I sold a home on Thanksgiving Day one day. And on Thanksgiving Day, I can't remember, I think it was right, these people had finished their dinner, and I think it was before ours, so there was about a 2 or 3 hour window there that I spent with these people, and, you know, sold some property. Everybody was happy. And
made it to dinner?
Yeah, I made it to dinner. You know, so you do those things. You know, that's just part of it. You know, your life's kind of controlled by everybody else. And, you know, it's part of the business.
Are there any other general routines that you might go through from time to time in the course of the day?
Well, we had organized times that we had a staff meeting once a week, and a multiple listening service, which involved all the offices in town, met once a week.
What would that be about?
Well, it was a meeting basically for everyone to talk about new properties listed. Sales that were pending. It was just a weekly update on the service, basically, with everybody together in a formal meeting talking about those things, new things on the market, property sold, changes making in listings, any other, you know, organized activities that involve, you know, the multiple listing service. We tour property once a week, line up a tour of normally newly listed properties around the valley. That. And then there were, you know, organizational meetings at the County Board of Realtors, and that monthly. There's a Rental Owners Association that was actually not part of that, but I belong to that, and that had monthly meetings.
Yeah, I think we talked about
fairly
that.
Organized group.
How does a real estate person make their money? How do they make their income, I should say?
Well, typically, The standard, not always, but typically the standard is 100% commission.
What does that mean?
Well, that means that you do not have a guaranteed salary, nothing per hour, nothing by the week or month, not a salary-based income. It's a commission-based income only paid to you when you close a sale. When the sale closes, you get paid. If you don't ever close a sale, you never get paid. So,
it says a lot about motivation, I would say.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
You earn what you produce.
Uh-huh. Were there people who couldn't produce?
Oh, yeah. Very high turnover rate.
In this occupation?
Yes. Yes. People get into it and for different reasons just aren't successful. And your most offices, brokers that you work for, sales managers tell people that don't expect any income for a few months, because it takes a while. Even if you have a sale or a listing that sells the very first day you work, it takes 30 to 60 days for sale to close. So no income until the sale closes.
Would you say that people would, that this would still be a primary occupation, that people would not normally engage in other employment at the same time?
Didn't used to be. There was used to be a lot of part-time salespeople. That's changed in the last 10 years especially, and even more so the last 5 years, that there aren't very many part-time people. The license laws change. They've got a fairly strict license law. It takes quite a bit of education to qualify to take the state exam. It's highly regulated by the state. And it takes a fair investment money-wise, time-wise, to accomplish that. And it didn't used to be. It used to be that it was very easy to get a license. And yet you always had to take a state exam. But once you had your license, there weren't a lot of license requirements. And if it's easy to take, there was no requirements to take the exam. Now there's quite a few. There's a set number of hours of education to take, even to qualify to take it. And then the license law is more strict. And so it's just really weeded out the part-time people. It's mostly full-time people. There's a few part-time people, but generally it's more full-time. Percentage-wise, it's hard to say 80-90% full-time probably. And, years back, probably only half the people were full-time.
Would you say that it was more than a 40-hour work week typically?
Well, no. On the average year in and year out, probably not. You hear about people working 60-80-hour weeks, and sometimes you do that, but, probably on the average, if it's a 40-50-hour week. Sometimes you have really long days, sometimes you might work all weekend, but being self-employed, which actually, technically, and under state law, you're self-employed, and people you work for generally would have some basic guidelines of when you needed to be in the office and that sort of thing, but if your work is in order and you can afford to do it, you could take time off during the week. And you might work weekend, but then you might take a day off during the week or something, and you could arrange it. So you had that luxury of being able to regulate your time that way.
So in the course of your typical work week or your typical work pattern, let's say, then would you have specific goals set for yourself? I'm trying to say, I'm going to sell so many houses this month or this year.
I guess I actually never did myself set down written goals. Sales managers, sales training people say you should do that. You should have list X number of properties a month to generate X number of sales. Listings are the key to the business more than sales. Because if you have the listings, there's a percentage of them that will sell. If you don't have listings, then you don't have sales. Although you can sell other people's listings. So I guess there's grays in that area. Rather, it's not all black and white. But some offices make people set goals. Bigger sales offices in bigger towns will make people set goals to so many listings, so many sales. People I worked for didn't do that, and I didn't really do that. I knew in my own mind what I had to do to produce the amount of income that I was looking for. So, you had that motivation. But I didn't have a chart on the wall with check marks by it or anything like that. I knew what had to happen. And I knew that, it's if you don't spend all your time like a normal work day, you just can't come in and out and spend a couple hours a day and expect to be successful. You need to put in an 8-hour day or a 10-hour day, 5 days a week. You need to be at it all the time. And if you do those things, then generally you're going to have some success. And that's the way I always did it.
Now, when you, I think we covered a little bit about what the multi-listing was in the previous interview, but if you sell something that's listed by another office than yours, is it a commission share? How does that work for the real estate person?
The mobile listing service had a customary, not set in writing, but there was a customary commission share. If one office had a listing and the other office sold it, they would you know, had an agreed upon split in the total commission. And then when that commission went to the individual office, then each office had a policy, a written policy on what that office share of it was, what the salesperson share of it was, depending on the circumstances. And it varied if it was another office's listing. The split, the in-office split was different than if it was, say, you sold a listing in your own office, for example. The split was different.
Is that the way it
for various reasons.
Is that the way it operates today?
Pretty much, yeah. Well, pretty much that is the way it operates. I think it's about every, well, I would say exclusive, but that's...
Did it always work out? I guess that would be a question of mine, too.
Seemed to, uh-huh. Yeah. You typically would get a higher split on your own in-house sale listing than you did another office's listing. But, you know, they average out. You know, you go to the mobile listing service in most towns anymore, or counties, whatever the geographic areas for mobile listing service, just about every area has a mobile listing service, and they all operate typically the same way.
Did you have an area of specialization in the real estate market?
Well, in a small town, unlike big towns, you just about have to be a general practitioner. Although I did a lot of commercial work, everybody does residential work. That's kind of the bread and butter is residential. Commercial was always interesting, and I did, you know, some of that, maybe more than some did. In bigger areas, you know, people will specialize maybe all commercial or all residential. There's enough business there to do that. But, you know, small towns like the Grand, you can't do that. Be successful. Some have tried. They're not around anymore.
Are there? This was a question of mine. Are there real bonuses or features in the real estate market that can happen from time to time in terms of selling? Or?
Well, you can always have a big sale. You know, you could have an average house sale today in LeGrand. I think the average price of a home in LeGrand today is a little over $100,000. When I started in 1973, probably the average was $12,000 to $15,000 for a home. I sold lots and lots of homes for $12,000 to $15,000 in the early 70s. And you know, then a big sale was $200,000 to $300,000. Today, a big sale is maybe $700 to $1 million. You know, those aren't real common, but you know, if you happen to be involved in one of those, of course, the fee splits are, you know, the dollar amounts are a lot higher.
Sure. Did you accomplish any of those big sales?
Well, I did. I sold a ranch, probably my largest sale, and that was quite a few years ago. It was a ranch in Malheur County, a big ranch, about 50,000 acres. Sold for a little over $1 million.
Is that
today? It'd be, you know, $7 million today. Inflation.
Is it competitive in that particular area or aspect of the business?
Well, it not so much here because that in Malheur County it is. People in Malheur County, there's a lot of quote ranch specialists in Malheur County. Everybody likes to think they're ranch specialists in Malheur County, I think, because there's a lot of turnover in big ranches. Here, it's not a big item. There's not much turnover. Not many of them really get on the market. And they aren't ranches. They're ag farms more than cattle like that in Malheur County. So it's not a big part of the business here.
Let's move on to back to the National Guard for a while. Now, we basically talked about the training, where you took your training, and I think I would like to come back a little bit to the actual drilling. Now, this will be unique for people, of course, who are in the Guard now, even from the time I came into the Guard, because it had moved from this one evening, a couple of times a month, did you say, to the weekend thing. So what sort of things would go on when you would drill? Those were, I'm guessing, several hours on a Monday night.
Well, my position in the Guards is a really unique drilling had a different meaning to me than it probably did to all the three or four people on this unit. I had to be the company clerk.
Right.
And while everyone was, quote, drilling, I was in the office. Someone had to man the phone, be in the office all the time, and I was the one. And myself, the first sergeant from time to time, and the CO manned the office. But I was there all the time. I was 100% time. I spent no time on the drill floor. But to go further, you know, my drilling experience actually was working in the office, because that was my job, and so that in effect was my drill.
That was your military occupation.
That was my MOS. Mm-hmm. And so my training was working in the office, unlike maybe someone that was in the infantry out, you know, on the range or working on the tanks. Well, I mean, the motor pool was in the back, you know, out in the back, and you probably remember that. And that was, you know, their drilling was, of course, doing mechanical work.
Right.
And the medics were doing, you know, their part. And
I know that. Let's back up a little bit.
I don't know if that's answered your question.
Well, it does answer mine. I'm not sure for the bigger picture, however, then. So what was LeGrand a headquarters outfit?
LeGrand was headquarters
at the time that you were in.
Right.
And what was the main purpose of that? Was it infantry, armor?
It was infantry.
It was infantry.
Right. And we had a headquarters battalion. We had a company, headquarters company, and then the battalion headquarters was in the same building, which was the old armory.
And were you part of the unit or were you part of the battalion?
I was part of the unit.
Okay.
And down the hallway on the other end of where our office was all the battalion headquarters.
Right. And naturally, this was all in the old armory over by the
school.
Cool.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. And so what would your company members, other than you, for your job, say? What was their focus and what would they be drilling, for example, on that? And what night of the week was it?
Monday night.
Monday. Was it one Monday a month, two?
We drilled generally every Monday night.
Okay.
And then one Sunday a month.
What would the typical hours be?
7 to 9 on Mondays evenings.
Okay.
And then all day 8 to 5 or so on Sundays. And you know, a typical drill day, you'd come in and start your day with everybody being in formation out on the drill floor. And you'd have some sort of a little inspection or something, and then everybody would go to their own unit in the company, motor pool, medics, kitchen, whatever. I was in the office.
But I mean the unit itself that you were clerk for.
The headquarters company.
Was the headquarters company. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And the headquarters company included the motor pool, the medics, the, you know, that sort of thing. So everybody would go to their own little area and spend the day either in training within, you know, the medics were training, or the motor pool, they were working on equipment, you know, and that was all, of course, training. As they were working, they were being trained.
And this is what the troops would be doing after that. Would you go to the initial formation?
No.
No, you'd stay in the office and be on the phone. So,
I would.
So as personnel specialist, then, that included, what things did you do for your soldiers?
Well, we did what's called a morning report, which was a daily report of the condition of the company in the mornings, the status of the company, what people were doing.
Would that be like how many people were present, who was ill, who was...
Right. Right. We did one of those every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of the day, I mean, my day would be... did a lot of typing, you know, typing reports. You were kind of a secretary, really, for the CO, for the first sergeant. They needed paperwork done, you were the one that did it, filling out discharge papers, or if there was a new recruit, there was paperwork to do.
For
their enlistment, you know, that sort of thing. And you were basically the secretary.
Did people, when they enlisted into your unit, did they enlist directly into these units at that time?
Yeah.
Did they didn't work necessarily for recruiters like recruiting offices work today?
You know, I don't recall that, because when I enlisted, I just went down here to headquarters company and told them I wanted to join, and they did it all right there. You're enlisting in the Oregon National Guard, and they're a function of that, and so you're you enlist locally, but you're enlisting in the Oregon National Guard. But each, and I think each company around the state had the ability to enlist people, and that's normally the way it went. You enlisted here, and your time, you started here, and your time was spent here other than your active duty time.
So did you have to go to an entrance processing station, an AP station, on your way?
I did not.
You did not. And so after you enlisted, so I assume you would take the oath of office right there here
right.
in the armory with an officer. And then how long was it between the time you took that oath and you went to basic training?
Well, my time, let's see, I'm trying to remember if there was a required... when I enlisted in the program, I was a senior in high school. And I don't remember if there was a minimum, maximum time that you had to be, that you were in the Guards before you went on active duty. I'm sure there was. But in my case, I was still in high school. I joined the spring of my senior year. And then in August of that year, I went on active duty the end of August, which was 4 or 5 months after I joined. And at that time, you spent a full 6 months, unlike now, I think now is the time varies depending on your class. You go to basic training, you go to your advanced infantry training, which is trains you in whatever your MOS is. And then I think you're released from active duty. My active duty time was a set 6 months.
That was what you'd offer me.
That's what you agreed to do, was 6 months of active duty initially. Training.
And that covered both of these training?
Well, it actually covered three things. It covered basic training, it covered AIT, which is advanced infantry training, and then whatever time you had left after advanced infantry training until the end of your 6 months, you actually went out and worked in your MOS at a job,
just a regular
8-to-5 job. I was down in Fort Ord, and I worked after my 2 months of basic training, 2 months of AIT, then I had about 2 months of just actual on-the-job time, and I spent it in a battalion headquarters,
working
as a personnel administration specialist with my MOS.
So did that give you the skills you needed when you came back to work in with Rand?
Pretty much, yeah, it was good training. Yeah. The AIT school was very good instructors, and it was good training.
Now did it stay on the Monday night program the whole while that you were in?
Well, it did up to the last year. The last year, it went to weekends. And I guess maybe, depends how you look at it, fortunately or unfortunately, I was one of the last few that enlisted under an old program that said you had to have 3 months of active guard time after you complete your 6 months of active duty time. You had an 8-year total obligation, but
only
3 years of active time after your 6 months.
So I stayed about 3.5 years
probably
of active time after my 6 months.
And then, being in the position I was in, I typed my own discharge papers and laid them on the CO's desk and told him that we were going to part company. And he said, I want to see you go. Hate to see you leave, but I can't do anything about it. So have a nice
He's
day.
Signed.
He signed. Then I spent the remainder of the in standby, which is my name's on a roster.
Was the unit ever on alert for active duty for Vietnam?
No, I was there before Vietnam. Vietnam was a place that no one had heard of when I was in the Guards. In fact, when I was in basic training, they showed us a film one time, and this was in 63, of a little unheard of country in Southeast Asia called Vietnam. And we have some, they're having a little turmoil over there, but,
you know, it isn't
much, but we do have some advisors
here,
and here's what they're doing.
And they
showed
us about an hour's training film on Vietnam, and people kind of wondered,
that's interesting, but really didn't think much about it, and we went on about it today and promptly forgot about it.
So, there was no draft in your era, then?
There was.
There was
well, yeah,
draft
was very active then.
Right.
And it was.
Were you draftable?
I forgot how high school I was. Well, no, I was going to go to college. And so you could get a deferment
going to college.
But I was registered for the draft.
Like everyone who was 18, you registered.
And
the draft was active.
And than I would have been deferred until I got out of college. But then I would have been very drafted.
What were the attitudes between enlisted and officer personnel in your time?
Here at the local union.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good relationship. Most of them were your, a lot of them are personal friends outside of the army.
So how did that?
People you run around with, you know.
Right. So how did that affect your when you put on a uniform?
Actually, it worked well. Most everybody in the guard was there because of their own choice. They wanted to be there, like myself. And so, you know, you had good relationships with people there. You know, I never personally had a problem with anyone. There was, you know, time to time there would be, you know, some conflicts. I mean, an officer was an officer, and they were in charge, and they had to keep the list of people, you know, in line, which not very many people got out of line, but, you know, there would be occasions where that happened. But I never personally saw that, you know, anybody that had a friendship outside of the guards, you know, in life away from the armory had any difficulties with that.
By these friendships with people, would people interact, whether they were enlisted or officer, if they already had these friendships outside of relationships outside, did they continue to interact?
Outside the guard?
Outside of the guard?
Yeah. Yes, I think so, yeah. Yeah, I had, you know, several friends people that I knew that were officers when I went in.
Okay, you were talking about, you said that you had friendships established already with a few officers before you went in.
Right, the CO, commanding officer, was a personal friend. His wife and my wife were in college together, and they studied together, and she spent time at their home study. He was a little bit older, they were better, he and I weren't as close of friends as his wife and my wife were, but when I went to Pendleton to get on the plane for active duty, he and his wife drove me to Pendleton to catch the plane, and we remained good friends all the time he was here. He eventually left the Grand and left the unit here at State of the Guards, but he was my boss, my primary boss here. Being the company clerk, he was the company commander, and I worked directly under him. We had a good relationship.
Would you say that how about the dress, the military appearance, was it the same in the guard as it was on active duty? Was it looser? Was it?
No, it was. We, you know, the company maintained a fairly strict dress. I mean, you had to be dressed appropriately for whatever the dress of the day it was. And everybody pretty well adhered to it. I think people took pride in how they looked. I know I did. And you took good care of your uniforms. And you know, when you go to drill, you were in full uniforms, normally it's fatigues. Once in a while, they'd have a dress-up thing you wear your greens for, your dress uniform. And it was fairly similar to that.
That's my next question. Any military parades or special events or things that you participated in?
We were in a few parades. I guess I was only in maybe two or three, but, you know, there'd be the typical, you know, like Veterans Day, Memorial Day, local things. I never did do anything uptown, but I was in a few parades downtown.
Did you ever have any military ceremonies where, like, say, the adjutant general showed up or some visiting dignitary that you had to prepare for in this area?
We did. I wasn't directly involved in, you know, those type of things because, here again, my time was in the office.
Yeah.
When those things happened, everybody was out there but the company clerk. But there would be times that we were visited by the commanding general for the Oregon Guard. He would make visitations because we worked with the battalion headquarters. And that, you know, probably, I don't remember for sure, but at least once a year. I mean, the commander, I mean the Supreme Commander was the governor of the state of Oregon, but the general of the guard would visit us. He, at that time, was a local resident and a personal friend of mine.
Who was it
that
time?
David Baum.
Oh.
He was the general, and the battalion commander also lived in the Grand, and he was a personal friend of mine, was Bill Carey.
Is that right?
He was my attorney at the time. He was our family attorney.
He became an adjutant.
Yes.
General, didn't he?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
He ended up, I think he was commander of the Oregon Guard for a while. But both of those men lived in the Grand during the time that they were in those positions.
I didn't know that.
We
had big brass come from the Grand as well.
We did. Uh-huh. Yeah, as big as it could get in Oregon.
Huh.
Yeah.
Were you personal friends with both of them?
I was. Uh-huh. Yeah, good friends with both of them. Yeah. Bill Carey was a member of our church, and he's passed away 2-3 years ago. His wife is still a very good friend of mine. She's still here in the Grand.
Okay.
Along with David Baum's wife.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting, my daughter is David's granddaughter, was my daughter's maid of honor in her wedding last year.
Uh-huh.
They've been close friends all through school. And the fellow that did my root canal was his son-in-law. It's a small world.
The connections are
intertwined.
Let's go back to the dance band. Tell me more about rehearsing for the dance band. How did you put your act together? Did you have regular rehearsal? How did that work?
Well, the first one, when we were really young, the Blue Notes, the father of our drummer, his name was Clark Wheeler. He was a very good musician. He had his own dance band that he played in, or group, and played the tenor saxophone, also sang, very talented man. His son was our drummer, and Clark was the one that actually kind of would help us practice, and he gave us music. He had lots of orchestrations, which is a orchestration.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Had all the parts, you know, and so Clark would lay these out for us and kind of help us through them, and direct us, and give us guidance, and work with us. He practiced lots and lots with us, and we gained a lot of good experience from Clark.
Did you have regular time?
You know, we did, and I don't recall when, but we practiced probably once a week. We'd get together, and there was, we had 5 pieces, I guess, at the time. Later, when I played with the Tone Dusters, they were already up and running, and they were all good musicians, and they did their own, they were their own guidance, you know, as far as they had. When I went to work for them, they had their own repertoire of songs. What I needed to do was just learn them. They had the way that they liked to play them, and everything worked except bringing the new guy, which was me, on board and getting me up to speed with them. We practiced probably here again maybe once a week until mainly for my benefit. And once I got up to speed, we played quite a bit, and probably our practice times really varied then. We might only practice maybe once a month then, because we were playing, you know, a lot of times through the season. We were playing every weekend, sometimes 2 nights a week, 1 night a week, and we practiced mainly to learn new material, and that might only be once a month.
So you'd work more than you practiced after you got down the basic repertoire of music that you played for them?
Yeah, and the season would be from October, November through, in those days there was lots of winter formals, college, high schools around. That was always a big time, and those would be in November, December. And you'd have a little lull in January, and then you get kind of back into the season with proms and spring formals and that sort of thing, because the schools all kids all did that sort of thing. I remember they usually have three or four formals a year, three anyway. All the schools did, and so, you know, we were playing for lots of them, and that was kind of, you know, it's kind of our specialty, was that type of music.
It sounds like you make good money at it.
Well, we did at the time. Yeah, it was a good part-time job. I think, like I mentioned before, you know, you could work one or two nights a week. Of, you know, as a prom, you only played for 3 hours. Once in a while, you'd have a four-hour dance to play for, but three was very typical. 9 to 11, or 8 to 11 was, you know. And you could make as much, you know, on that night, or for sure 2 nights, as someone would working part-time at a job all week long after schools, taking time away from lots of other things, studies, or whatever, you know. We were out having fun in the evening, which didn't take away from anything.
I take it you didn't bring books along, did you?
Oh, we did. Every time we went, we took books. Really, really booked it between songs, you know, you get the book out. No, it was a lot of fun. I mean, it was a good time. I mean, it was a job. It was lots of, I mean, musicians play because they like to play.
Right.
You know, it's not a job. It's a fun thing to do.
Tell me about your crowd behavior. What kind of behavior of the crowd at the time that you played? Were it varied?
Well, the school crowds are always good, you know, and we never had any bad crowd behavior. The schools were always, you know, very good. Public dances, we played some public dances. We played up at Joseph at quite a few public dances in what was called Hell's Canyon. It was a big Quonset hut building that was kind of in the middle of town where they held lots of public dances. And they were always on Saturday night. We'd play from 8 till 12 or 1, and that was, you know, a little longer night to play. And of course, it was open to the public. Anybody could come. And there'd always be, you know, there was always people there that had been drinking. I mean, that was pretty standard, you know. And once in a while, I really don't remember inside of ever having anything very rowdy inside. I mean, outside, and especially in Joseph, things could get a little out of hand from time to time. But nothing that really, you know, directly affected us. We played in a few nightclubs. Everybody really was, you know, we never really had any difficulty, any bad experience. We were fortunate everybody was having lots of fun and was there for a good time. And you know, things could get rowdy sometimes, but we never experienced it, I guess. You know, we all know that goes on and that happens.
Yeah. Certainly can.
Yeah.
Let's go back to school days for a few minutes for wrapping up our hour, I promise you here. Let's talk about junior and senior high. What kind of routines or rituals did you go through at the time on a daily basis being in school? Bill. You know,
rituals, your class schedule.
Class procedures, things like that. Were there routines or rituals you went through?
Well, I'm not sure what you're after. In junior high, everybody had a home room. And you went, and I don't think that's still common. I think it was not.
I've been out too long.
Yeah, but your first class of the day was your home room. So you would, you know, that started your day. If there was any school business or they took a lunch count or anything, any news about the school or anything that was kind of general, not specific to your classes, that took place in your home room. And then I think in junior high we had six or seven classes during the day. And 4 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, I think, was the way it went. I think school started at 8 or 8:30. Lunch was 45 minutes, I'm for 40 to 45 minutes.
Did you do flag salutes at that time?
You know, I believe we did. I think I'm not real certain on that, but I think in the home room we did. I know it was very acceptable at the time. And One Nation Under God was very acceptable at the time. No one had a problem with it, including myself. And those things just weren't an issue. You know, there's lots of activities in junior high. I was a member of the ski club. We snow skied a lot. I was in track. Ninth grade ran is what I did. But they used to, the school used to have ski buses. We went up to the old Spout Springs ski area. Anthony Lakes then was just a rope hill up the side of the hill. Developed ski area really other than that one rope hill. Spout Springs, which was up at the toll gate between Elgin and Dump Freewater, that was the place to go. That was a big ski area, and everybody went to it. There was people from Walla Walla, Dump Freewater, Pelton. There was always lots of people there. But the school took buses. They'd run two or three buses up there on Saturdays. And they had a ski club that was, your activity revolved around skiing, and you had a little meet once a month or something, or whatever. But the focus was get on the bus and go skiing.
How about things like hall activity, moving about between classes? Did you have to have a hall pass to get out of the class during the period?
Not really. Recall in junior high, if you needed to go do something, it seemed like you had to check in. You could check in with, I think the procedure was to go to the office, telling me, if you had a doctor's appointment or something during the day, or needed to be gone for a family reason or something, you'd go to the main office, and then they'd give you some sort of a written request from your parents or your doctor, and then they give some writing to give your teacher that you're going to be missing your class or classes.
Did you need passes in high school?
No. No, that came along after my time. Right. Kind of the same procedure in high school.
About either junior or senior high clothing fads?
Oh, there was lots
during
of fads.
Time,
right.
Anything you participated in or you recall?
Well, at the time, everybody in that era was really dressed nice. I used to wear, when I was in ninth grade in high school, I'd wear nice slacks, a lot of times a white shirt and a sweater. That was real common. Dressing
was that
nice.
Actually expected?
Not from the school, it wasn't. That was just the fad at the time. When I was in junior high, all the cool guys wore Levi jeans down around their hips and a white t-shirt and white bucks.
You mean these low-riding pants like you see on some of the kids today? Or
well, they weren't tailored to be low-riding. They just made them low-riding. Mm. You just pull them down far enough, they made them low-riding, and of course, the seat was baggy,
and that was in junior high.
That was in the early 60s.
Uh-huh.
Blue jeans and either saddle shoes, the old the tan and brown saddle shoes, or white bucks. A lot of the guys wore white t-shirts and Levi's. It was kind of the happy days crowd.
Were there hairstyles?
There was. That was a time. Just kind of right in that few years that kind of the greasy bucktail hair or the ducktail hairdos were in style. Slick back hair, and you were really cool if you had ducktails.
Did you do that?
I made an attempt at it. My hair never really worked very well for that.
Didn't cooperate?
Didn't quite cooperate. Huh. Then it went from there to a flat top.
So that was a fad?
That was a fad. Yeah. Flat tops were really a fad. That was the kind of beginning of high school in the early 60s. And that was about 1960. And the dress kind of went up, kind of from jeans to... When you wore jeans, they were nice jeans. They weren't holy jeans like they are today. They were nice Levi's, you know, and not very faded. They got to be too faded, then you replaced them.
Were there dress codes then? Could you be sent home for...
I don't recall there being a written code as such. The accepted dress for girls was a dress, not pants, or not jeans. I don't know that that was a policy, an administration policy, but that was a peer policy that girls rarely wore pants to school or jeans. I mean, if you wore jeans to school, you were there to do some work on your hands and knees. Everybody wore dresses or skirts.
It meant a work day?
If you wore jeans. Yeah. But your normal classroom day, girls wore dresses, skirts, and just rarely wore pants. But I don't know the pants would be against the school policy. Some guys, you know, were pretty presentable. I mean, your clothes were, you know, nice clothes as far as being nice, as far as being well kept, not holes in the knees. And you didn't buy clothes that already had holes in the knees in those days. So, completely different dress than it is today. Just almost the exact opposite. And when I was in high school, like I say, everybody really dressed nice. Would rarely wear jeans to high school. They were always khaki pants or something else. I mean, you wear jeans sometimes, it's okay, but you know, when the weather got a little cooler, sweaters were really popular then. Nice shirt and sweater and jeans, or slacks of some kind, you know, khaki type slacks or whatever. So the dress then was much nicer than it is today. I guess, lack of a better word, not near as casual.
What do you know about, of course, we're not saying that you know anything personally about this, but what do you know about delinquency at the time?
The delinquency wasn't very high. I think the attendance then was better than it was up to recent times, maybe. We did not have an attendance officer like we do today to keep kids in school. And there was always a dropout then as there is now. But I think, in comparison today, I think it was pretty small. It'd be interesting. I'd really like to see the statistics from that era, because it wasn't very high. Most everybody stayed. And of course, we didn't have the pressures. I don't think we had the social pressures then that there are today. Mainly drug problems would be the number one thing to distract kids, give them a diversion from going to school. There's always a certain amount of alcohol, and kids smoked then. But those things didn't keep you out of school. You got out of school either, there's always kids that just won't go to school. I mean, they think there's a better way to do it than go to school then as there is now. But
of course, now I take it you went to school in your high school years. You weren't downtown like you were in first grade at Macklemore. You yourself were not. What would happen if you were absent unexcused? Did that have to be explained?
It did, and you could be expelled. I mean, there was then like now, you could be expelled for 2 or 3 days. They could send you home for a day or 2 or 3 days, or just kick you out of school. I mean, there was isolated cases that happened. I mean, kids were just bad enough that they'd get expelled.
What do you know about any possible, I suppose, sexual activity among students at that time?
Well,
what was the feeling? What was the...
In those days, I don't know that I would say that morals, well, I would say that morals were better. And I guess that's a kind of a little bit of a matter of definition too, but for a girl to be pregnant and go to high school was absolutely taboo. That just would
not
happen.
Bad.
That just would not happen. And of course it's a matter of record that teen pregnancies were much less then than they are now. And kids would, you know, there was always, I mean, go out and park, neck, and, you know, that sort of thing. But, you know, that, you know, went on then just like today. But, it seems like, you know, the issues of girls being pregnant at their worst men, you know, just didn't happen. And I think the sexual mores then were much tighter than they are now, or better. I mean, things weren't near loose then as they are now. And that all reflects on, you know, that has a reflection on your values and your behavior. I mean, things that are acceptable now, it's just a matter of everybody looks and shrugs their shoulders, would be taboo when I was in school. It just would not happen.
Could students be married in high school?
It could be. And there was
were there
a couple of cases of that, yeah. And they would, the ones I remember, one of the spouses, generally the man, was already out of high school. And maybe he married a younger girl when she was in school. I can remember one or two cases that happened. But, you know, she'd go to school and was accepted and didn't seem to be too big of an issue.
How about principals and counselors? More involved with students?
Well, our principals here in high school were always really involved. We had principals that were really respected and liked, and they, you know, they would involve themselves, you know, in activities. You know, they'd always speak to you, and always had a good relationship with, you know, the administrators. Not so much the superintendent, he was someone you didn't see much of, but the principal, vice principal, there was a counselor, a men's boys counselor, and a girls counselor. And, you know, being counselors, they were people type, you know, people oriented people, and they would be involved with the kids, easy to talk to. You know, I can always remember having a good relationship with those people.
Were your counselors in school, were they full time at that?
They were full time.
Yeah. Rather than teaching the counsel.
Yeah, they had a full-time counselor, men's, boys, and taught. I don't recall if they taught, if they did. It was they spent more time counseling than they did teaching. Yeah.
Any of them stand out that you worked with?
Well, we only had, you know, we only had one, and there was some news.
They basically covered student body.
They did. They had one.
Boys and the girls.
Right. Uh-huh. Right. So, just got the one.
Any major, what were the popular foods of your day?
Not a lot different than they are today, just a little limited diet, I think, because there's so much stuff now. But we, you know, hamburgers are always a big thing, hamburgers and fries. We used to go downtown at noon, there was, you know, the guys that had cars, we, you know, one of my friends in particular, he'd have a car load at noon, we'd probably two or three days a week, we'd go down to the old Arctic Circle, which is down, actually, it's across the side street from Safeway. Arctic Circle. That building's still there, but it's, you know, it's not. It was built for an Arctic Circle, and we used to refer to it as either the 1-9 Club or the 6-4 Club. The 1-9 Club meaning you could get a hamburger for 19 cents,
uh-huh.
Or the 6-4 Club is you could get two hamburgers, fries, and coke for 64 cents.
What a deal.
Yeah. So we, and then there was another little drive-in called Bobby's Drive-In, and it's where Ranch and Home Realty is now at the beginning of the truck route of Jefferson. And when Jefferson comes into Lynch Motors, just across from Lynch Motors and straight down Jefferson a block where it makes a bend to the left, that building on the right is Ranch and Home Realty. Well, that was built for a lady by the name of Bobby, I can't remember her last name, but it was Bobby's Drive-In. And she had a drive-up window, and then a little, just a little counter. You could go inside, and they had bar stools, just maybe six round little bar stools, the old-style counter, and a couple of tables if you wanted to go inside. But everybody used the drive-thru. You could get five hamburgers for a dollar there.
Was that, so was that tough to come up with a dollar?
No, not really. Because school lunches were 50 cents to a dollar, so you know, if you got money for parents or whatever, I mean, if you were going to not go home for lunch, and I went home about half the time during the, you know, I'd go home for lunch or either drive, usually if I, and I had a drive by then, I didn't have my own car, but the parents' car or something like that, or the other days you'd go down to the, usually the Arctic Circle or Bobby's Drive-In, and you know, for a buck, you'd get more than you could eat, you'd get five hamburgers for a dollar, so for, usually we, you know, there'd be five or six of us in the car, and we could always eat lunch for $2 for the drink.
Those places sound like what we called hangouts when I was in school. Were there other hangout places that are not here today that,
well, really,
were popular then?
Actually, the hangout place was Nell's In-N-Out. And that's, you know,
and here, that's always been here now, hasn't it?
It's been there since 1955.
Yeah.
Yeah. The others really weren't hangouts. I mean, they were just places to eat. Mm-hmm. There's really no place to be there. I mean, just get your food and leave. Or head down the street, or
but Nell's drag could the be gut, a hangout.
You know, but Nell's was kind of a hangout. You could pull in there and park.
Now, it's been there in that same location all along.
Same location. They had a fire a number of years ago that burned up the building, and they rebuilt the building right in the same footprint, and just modernized it. But everything's just the way it was then. They've put out, they've got a canopy there on the side. They've got some tables underneath that. Park anywhere. Normally the prime place to park was to get a drink, and then you pull right up in front there facing Adams, pull right along the nose into the sidewalk there, and so you could watch the street and see who was driving back and forth, dragging the gun, you know, up and down the street.
Well, let me just bring that, I'm glad we got to that, because that is something that a lot of people don't have any clue about anymore. Because they don't do that, and that is, so Adams was that a main drag, a drive, what was that like?
Well, the end
where
of
did it go to?
Well, you started at, then it was the old Safeway, now it's the new ODS building,
uh-huh.
And you drive around that block, one way or the other, depend which way you were going, but you drive around that block, all the way around that block, and that gets you back around on Adams. And then you go down Adams towards Baker, and the other end of it was down where Schwab lives. Either you turn around